Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chapter 27 of Chasing the Sun, an epic book by Richard Cohen. And I'm sort of pleased that I've decided to podcast through it because it's really tested me going through these hundreds of pages. We're up to page 475, so pretty well. If you have a whiteboard and you write down every way you can get the sun, and he's written a chapter on everything. So he's basically covered everything, but there's sort of certain gaps, I think, in solar physics, and might be one aspect. For some of the physics is not that strong, no. But and some of the analysis is to the side, but where it makes up is the sheer volume of analysis. I think Napoleon said quantity has a quality all of its own. That's a beautiful way of saying it. Okay, this is by Longfellow. So it's the title of the chapter is Busy Old Fool. And Longfellow in Evangeline. Down sank the great red sun, in the golden glimmering vapours veiled the light of his face, like the prophet descending from Sinai, whatever that means. Dick Francis in Smokestream. Apollo still raged away in the blazing sky, as one might say if one had to taste for that sort of thing. In the 20th century, novelists, poets, essayists made an extraordinary use of the sun. He considers himself a scientist and expert on butterflies, Vladimir Nabokov. I hadn't known his work well, but remembered that his final novel, Ada, 1969, the heroine and her brother, Venveen, wandered through the gardens of their ancestral home and begin to play a game. Ada explains the rules. The shadows of the leaves are on the sand were various interrupted by roundlets of live light. The player chose his roundlet, the best, the brightest he could find, and firmly outlined it with a stick, whereupon the yellow round light would appear to grow convex like the brimming surface of golden dye. Then the player delicately scooped out the earth with his stick and fingers with a roundlet. The level that the gleaming infusion de tu would magically sink into the goblet of the earth and finally dwindle to one precious drop. The player who made the most goblets in, say, 20 minutes. This is weird. Can I say that the most extraordinary thing of the sun I've ever done is when I went to a circus and they had little eyelets, and the eyelets produced a light at a distance, and the little round orbs had a little line between it because you actually got the diffraction properties between it. I haven't explained it very much well. So if I've got those little sun images. If you have it holds two so close together, you can actually get a diffraction pattern between the two. It's a very beautiful thing to observe. It's something that just caught me. I was in the big top and the light shone through and I saw the shadow and it just transfixed me. I haven't forgotten about it. Dear, there's a picture of Vladimir Nabokov, who died at 78. He died in 77, and he was born in 1899. This interested me because Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle, takes the title from the game played by the Eskimos, wherein children try to ensnare the sun with string. Same idea, different method. Then, as I read more of Nabokov, I realised the sun recurs with particular urgency throughout his work. The deceived lover of laughter in the dark cries out for sunlight at the very moment he discovers his mistress's infidelity. Now, Schopenhauer's, I just got to remember that. In Blend Sinister, the protagonist Krug perceives the word loyalty as being like a golden fork lying out in the sun, and pale fire glows with solar reflections. There are many other instances. Nabokov was unusually acute about the quality of sunlight, writing in his memoirs, "All colours make me happy, even the grey blood orange sun." His consciousness of the sun was heightened by his ability to lessen the effects of a case of paralysis. Okay, this is, he's done this before. This is some sort of skin disease, which is lessened by the sun. I think so you've got inability to remove dead cells, whereas there's another disease, skin disease, which, where the sun creates toxins in it. Okay, on occasion, so severe that incredible discernible almost drove him to suicide. Sunbathing and radiation treatments help in later life. He was also synesthetic. His biographer, Brian Lord, mentions, as a child, Orford had a love of colour and light. Both his mother and father saw letters of the alphabet in vivid tints, and he linked his first attempts at poetry with his mother's jewels and stained glass prisms and spectra and rainbows. Can I say that I just mentioned that to someone in passing, you don't have to know who, that I'm now occasionally see the lights, the different colours of equations, and they leapt on it and said, oh, this is interesting. For me, it was just, you know, just another weird thing to keep quiet. Okay, the theme of materials affected by sunlight, shines in all its glory in the scene of his first poem. After taking shelter from thunderous storms at the pavilion fire, Norgus sees the sun return and cast luminous coloured rhomboids on the floor of coloured grass, the lozenges of pavilion windows, while outside the rainbows slip into the view. And at that moment, his first poem begins. Can I say, it's similar to me. I have this love of the laser lab, the quality of laser lines as opposed to stimulated emission. ASC. Spontaneous emission. It's just amplified spontaneous emission. But CSE is another beautiful thing in itself, but I won't go into it. I should write some on laser physics for everyone. Boyne points out how Norbuckus would pay attention to the details of an order not expected, the haze over a frying pan, the colours and shapes and shadows. He had a painter's sense of light. Even so, I'm quite unprepared when I took up his masterpiece, Lita, a novel quite brimful with solar references, almost as if the author were having one of his private jokes. But this profligacy is not intended fastidiously at all. Drawing on the sun to an extent unequalled anywhere else in all literature, he uses it to remarkable effect. This is a large claim indeed and needs furnishing. The third novel is saturated with images of sunlight, dictating the narrative's mood and directing us with easy optimisms of Humbert's early hopes. In the opening sentence, Humbert presents Lolita as the light of my life and goes on to talk of the sun in my infancy having set. When he first spies Lolita through sun-speared eyes, and it is a sun-shot moment. She is a photographic image on a screen, already riding in a low morning sun. While her mother engages in some heliotropic fussing, Humbert focuses on sunbathing Lolita. There are prismatic layers of light. He can also take a sunshot pavement and reflect the afternoon dazzling white diamond, innumerable iridescent spikes that quivered in a round back of a parked car. When a few pages on, Lolita creeps up on him, putting her hand over his eyes. He reclines in a low chair. Her fingers were like luminous crimson as they tried to blot out the sun. Okay. Tick, tick, tick. Playfully, she tosses an apple into this sun-dusted air, and Humbert is soon lost in the pungent but healthy heat, which, like summer haze, hung about Little Haze, Haze being Louisa's surname. It implied sun pulsated in supplied populars. The sun was on her lips, all this in the first 60 pages. Such references are very different from the metaphor bank of the Romantics, in which the sun is primarily a standard-bearer of classical mythology. Nabrowski is observant to a fault, alive with anything that has sunlights upon it. He may use the sun for its symbolic power, as when he writes that Humbert dreams of, quote, the red sun of desire and decision, the two things that create the wide world. But naturalist that he is best as the subtle observer of the physical world around him, of the beauty of animation, the sun, the shadows, the leaves rippling on the white refrigerator. What? Or the southern boulevards of midday in the solid shade on the side of the smooth sunshine in the other. I can see there is, just looking around the garden, I just really love the way sun actually gets through the leaves. See where it, right? The web of images is effective both. Okay, let's read. Of the beauty and animation of the sun, shadows and leaves looking the white refrigerator. Although southern boulevards midday that have solid shade on one side and smooth sunshine on the other. I knew the sun shone, says Humbert, because my ignition key was reflected in the windshield. Nambuk's interest in light melded the lifelong fascination with butterflies. In at least one scene, we note that a big black glossy placard, one which later kills Lolita's mother, mounts the lawn and stands shining in the sun, its doors open like wings. Whatever that means. The web of images is effective in and of itself, and for the way it serves as part of a larger purpose to employ sunlight in all its many forms in the world of shadows and darkness to mirror what is happening in the central characters. Astonishingly, references to the sun appear about every three pages in his first third of the book. Movie ladies have sun-kissed shoulders. A moment of sexual epiphany is the ultimate sunbirth, while Lolita at her summer camp appears a sun-coloured little orphan. But such sunny days are numbered, and as part one ends, the language reflects a darkening mood. But somewhere behind the raging bliss, bewildered shadows conferred. This is the very time when Humbert first exults. She was mine, she was mine. His rainbow blood may be in full flow, but the images of the sunshine disappear, and those shadows close him. Secretly comes a tremendous sunset, which the tired child ignored, and before a short, brutal, near-rape scene, Humbert wildly pursues the shadow of her infidelity. In a sign that he cannot see his love objectively, when the sunburst strikes the highway along which he is driving, he has to pull in to a filling station for new sunglasses. But Claire Quilty, his eventual saviour, is now in hot pursuit, our shadow. Quilty, co-parent of Vivian Duckblum, an anagram for Vladimir Nabokov, while a number of Quilty's drama groups makes his debut in the play entitled Sunburst. This is weird New York stuff, you don't need to. I'm going to have to read to the end of this paragraph and see how many pages do we have to go through this one. Oh, God, this is just novels, God. But it's nothing as simple as Lolita representing the sun or the sun her. Once she seems to tire of Humbert, he confesses, I hear myself crying from doorway into the sun. And before long, he is admitting the sun has gone out of the game. After the love of his life has absconded, Humbert has a moment when he thinks he has glimpsed her. A trick of harlequin light, maybe. She writes a poem to her to remind her of the old perfume called Inevitably Soliviet. But she has left him forever, and he is forced to accept, I smugly did not know a thing about my darling's mind, and that quite possibly there was in her garden and a twilight. Sunsets are blotched, forcing Humbert to drive on and on through the drizzle of the dying day. When more than 2 years later he finds Lolita again, she is worn out, vast with a pregnancy that will kill her in her teens. What? Her smile, a frozen little shadow of itself, failing to get her to go back with him. He takes off into the night, intent on tracking and killing Quilty. And when in a ghastly fashion he does so, the sun was a visible game, burning like a man, leaving behind a corpse of her latest abductor while she walks away through the spotted gaze of the sun. Sounds a real, absolutely page shutter. You know, I just could, nothing would not interest me as much. Give me a good science book any day. Now, I'm going to have to stop briefly here. And it's page 149. Sorry, guys. I know this must be very frustrating for people out in podcast land to listen to any of this. 10 pages? Sure, we can't go that. 191? 93? 95? My God, this person is just totally... I shouldn't say... Australians would say, you up yourself, mate. Just shut up and tend to your Barbie. 97. So that's... I should be able to do that. That's... That's 18 pages. Is that right? No, that's... Yeah, it's 18 pages to go. Thanks a lot. I'll be back in a drop second. Okay, reading on from here. If Nabokov is a special case, we could recall the judgment of Maxim Muller that from the time that man first started to tell stories, he used the sun as an image. I would expect so. By the days of the epic poets, the whole of heavens have been drawn upon for metaphors and symbols. Which is, why he doesn't have Parmenides, I don't understand. In the Iliad, for instance, Homer, he is just a classic New York narrow-minded person. Sorry, a great man, but he just, he's really been fed on what people mention, drop names at dinner parties. It defines 650 characters with stars and finds them in 45 constellations of star patterns, each identified with a particular warrior, which such items as armor, chariots, spears are linked to objects in the sky. He even harnesses the procession of the equinox. The epic battles at the duels between the various heroes have been shown to be allegories of passage of equinoctial rising. The Iliad may be considered the world's oldest substantial astronomical text, using the zodiac to categorize the movements of the heavens. Such, at least, is a remarkable argument of Homer's secret Iliad, written in rough draft over a period of some 30 years by Edna Johnston, a librarian to an amateur literary critic from southeast Kansas, and published posthumously in 1999. There's an asterisk there. It is interesting, I forgot what the zodiac came from, the Babylonian zodiac. I should actually say that. Now, okay. Remarkably. Johnson was born in 1916 and studied in Kansas State Teachers College, taking mythology as one of her special subjects in learning ancient Greece. Over the next 3 decades, she read and reread the Iliad or the Odyssey until she could recite long passages from memory. At some point, she made her discovery. She had no wish, she said, to diminish the poem's narratives, dense with well-drawn characters, convincing plots, pathos, horror, excitement, clown, philosophy, and history, so on. I'll have to read. I'll podcast the Iliad. But she saw an overarching purpose in the two great works to preserve astronomical knowledge. Fearing that she might be out of her limb, she never made her findings public. At her death, daughter Florence and her son-in-law spent 7 years editing, expanding the various notes until they could finally publish the results. Well, there you go. Johnson's research convincingly suggested that Homeric epics might be among the first works of literature to incorporate a knowledge of the study of the sun's apparent motions, as if Homer were intent on settling down what was known about the heavens for future generations. And it is not only the Iliad that displays the extraordinary grasp of the astronomical knowledge, she says. In the Odyssey, the symbolism of Odysseus' return to home after 19 years may show Homer's grasp of the 19-year meteoric cycle, over the course of which the subsequent of the moon phases return to the same day of the year. Yeah, isn't that amazing? So 19 days, 19 years, the moon goes in sync almost. Homer uses the sun position to denote the time of Odysseus' departure from home. And when the child of morning rose's fearing dawn appeared, again they set sail. The year after Homer's secret Iliad appeared, the work of another amateur critic and another critic would show it too, at least in part, was dealt with astronomy. Dolores Curran first encountered Chaucer when she was a middle-aged college student in California and became caught up with his work. Now, this is really, really interesting because I think it's the amateur critics. There's this boundary between amateurs and people like that. But still, she was not satisfied. As I read, I was distracted by questions about the pilgrims. What made this precise group necessary? Chaucer's reputation was too well known, his skills too well recognised for me to think that the group had a haphazard collection. Why were there one pair of brothers, not from a religious order, but two men related by birth? Why not three brothers or no brothers? Why was there a wife, but no husband and wife? Why no children? Why so few women? In the Chaucer's Pilgrims, the allegory, she returns to the poet's interest in astronomy and argues that each pilgrim corresponds to bodies or bodies in the night sky, which reflect in name and appearance the mythical characters after which the constellations are called. The study is well received. Look, the entire thing is, it's not whether it's right, it's right. It's occupying intellectual space. It is generally known that Chaucer was highly versed in astronomy and in 1391 even penned a treatise on the astrolabe for his younger son, Lewis. Cullen shows his interest suffuses the Canterbury Tales, influencing not only the identities of the pilgrims but also their stories. From Franklin's tale, with the theories of tide and the effects of the perihelion, the time at which Earth and Sun are closest to each other, through to Parsons' tale about the uses of trigonometry, the canon's yeoman's tale about charlatan alchemist, the squire's tale, which he takes the precise relationship between the sun, moon, Mars, and onwards. Chaucer puts astronomy and its related disciplines to intense use. But unlike Homer, he does not seem to be writing for posterity so much as responding to subjects that interest him. Confidently, his audience at a time, familiarity with the movement of the heavens was taken for granted, and would share an interest. I just really think there is this thing. It's just, these are weird theories, but they miss the weirdest thing of all, which is Francis Bacon's New Atlantis tale, which is written out, and it's just, oh, it's just mind-blowing. This is, today's analysis of astronomical references to classical works have nothing over the ingenuity of those early biblical writers who brought such energy into explaining the motion of celestial bodies. For instance, the two lights mentioned in Genesis, sun and moon, were interpreted by the Catholic Church as representing the papacy, the greater light, and the empire, the old Roman Empire, currently the Holy Roman Empire, the lesser. Metaphorically, this meant that just as the moon receives light from the sun, so did the empire receive its light, that's interesting, authority from the church, and thus was subject to being overridden. Dante Alighieri, in De Monica, bravely rebuts this interpretation, and in this case gets away with it. Lucifer, light-bearer with all his positive connotations, caused a special problem for the early Christians. The name appears in the 14th chapter of the Old Testament, the Book of Isaiah, and nowhere else. It is popularized by the appearance in King James translation, although it first appears first in the 14th century version. The explanation is that the original Hebrew text, it was not an angel who falls, but Babylonian king, who during his lifetime had persecuted the children of Israel. The early Christian scribe made a change. Wow. Isn't that amazing? But his greatest work, he shows himself to be steeped in Christian symbolism of his time and contemporary understanding of astronomy that provided much of the imagery. All three books, The Divine Comedy, Inferno, Pergionato, and Parricido, rest on the structure of medieval astronomical doctrine, so that in Parricido, the souls are placed in rank. Their order reflects the doctrine of the planetary spheres aligned by Aristotle and Ptolemy. Isn't that amazing? I suppose that makes sense. And then Galileo, the Dome of Earth. While the organization of the Inferno almost exactly mirrors the assumed ninefold layout of the heavens. So the ninefold layout is three choirs and three ranks in every choir. It's very interesting. For instance, it indicates times of day through the oblique reference to the dawn light on the hillside, the hour of morning's prime on his soft aloft the sun ascended. At another moment, Dante realized that his journey through the heavens has completed a quarter of the daily revolution of the stellar sphere around the Earth. He has therefore spent 6 hours in Gemini, roughly the same amount of time Adam enjoyed the pleasures of Eden before being cast out. Now, directly beneath Cadiz, close to the westernmost shores of the Mediterranean, he sees an expanse of the Atlantic, and to the east, nearly as far as the Phoenician coast. Only this portion of the Earth's surface is visible to him because the sun lies two zodiacal signs behind, further west, beneath the Azores. The Bergadio refers more than once to the sun's position, since Dante uses it as a central device to establish the timing of events in the poem. In the Inferno, by contrast, he takes only the positions of the moon and the stars for this purpose, since the sun, as an expression of God's power, will not tell him the time in hell, the infinity of which is part of the horror. In Presido, he attains that the heaven of the sun, whose special virtue is wisdom. Two moments bear mention. Canto 33 in the Inferno has the first reference in literature to the sun's being fundamentally a star. I said nothing in answer to all the day and night next until another star rose on the world. And in Pregiato, pictured as a huge island mountain in the uninhabited southern hemisphere, the various souls Dante meets are shocked to discover that he's still alive by noticing that, unlike them, he casts a shadow. Isn't that incredible? So, there is, what is the, purgatory is an actual physical place in the southern hemisphere. That's a new thing to get in my head. Obviously, south, in, various things, the New Atlantis is in the southern hemisphere. Bergadio is in the southern hemisphere. Over the century, two main problems had to be faced in writing about the sun. First is the major theme that the temptation so grandiosely is hard to resist. Poets employed the sun at their peril, but some didn't make use of it with greater finesse than others. Thomas Malory, 1405 to 1471, introduces Gawain, a translation of Bright Star, into La Mort d'Arthur, published posthumously in 1485. As a sun spirit, the night gaining then losing strength when the moon's waxing and waning, so losing the sun's light. Edmund Spenser, 1552 to 99, trod the big theme tightrope with great skill in Epithalamion of the Wedding, a poem that can, like Homer's and Chaucer's work, be read as an astronomical text. By contrast, Milton's On the Morning of Christ's Nativity comes up with an image that is simply absurd. So when the sun is in bed, curtains with cloudy red, pillows chin upon an orient wave, the flocking shadows pale, troop the infail jail. The same time, similar does service to Marvel's Upon Appleton House, but he made up for this with to his cosy mistress. Though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we make him run. Robert Herrick, 1591-1774, was again decidedly pedestrian in his glorious lamp of the heaven, the sun. The higher he's getting, the sooner will his race be run, and nearer to his setting. Well, I can't, that's probably something I'd produce. The second part of the challenge in earlier times was that references to astronomy had to conform with the church doctrine on matters pertaining to the heavens. On account of the creation in Paradise Lost, Milton has to resolve the biblical conundrum of where light came from. That is interesting, where light came from, and that was inherit the earth is interesting aspect. My head is hurting trying to remember all these things. Yeah, I'm just trying to read. If the sun were created in only the fourth day and gets around it by having light shine from a nook under God's throne for those first few days, then I could find a fit place for the sun. Isn't that lovely? The solar creation myths. He probably decided to use the Ptolemaic astronomy because it was more in accord with scripture. Oh, that's right. I was trying to remember, it's Martin Luther King was anti, the Protestants were anti-Copernican more than anything else.
he can be master of purification in book, sorry, he can be the master of purification in book 10, man's fall thrusts the sun from an equinoctial robe, which can be read as either deflecting the sun from the course around the celestial equator, as Ptolemy Chrysostom requires, or tilting the earth on its axis in a steadily gaining Copernican system. During the 1,500 years of Ptolemy's doctrines held sway, writers were generally content to employ the sun for occasional grandstanding. John Suckling's "The Sun Upon the Holiday is Not So Fine a Sight About a Beautiful Girl Dancing." I have a soft spot for Suckling. During his short life, so he invented the game of cribbage. So I really don't understand what cribbage is. I'll have to... Yeah, wouldn't it be great to have a memory to look all this up? As an excuse for retelling famous myths, Sir Philip Sidney's sonnet, the sequence Astrophel and Stella, or as references to the point when examining the heavens. One exception is the Italian Giulio Camillo, 1482 to 1544, whose influential L'Idea del Teatro, the idea of the theatre, is nothing less than a history of the universe in which the sun holds pride place. Frances Yates, in her study that a writer explains his work, shows within the mind the memory of man of the Renaissance, the sun looming with a new importance, mystical, emotional, magical, the sun becoming the central significance it shows, an inner movement of the imagination towards the sun, which must be taken into account as one of the factors in the heliocentric revolution. References to Camillo's work have figured in texts of writers from Rousseau to Ted Hughes, whoever these people are. The sun was soon seized on throughout Europe as a royal emblem. Kings portrayed an allegory of the embodiment of the sun's glorious attributes, notably the City of the Sun by Camillo's countryman, Domenico Tommaso Campella, a philosophical dialogue fashioned after Plato's Republic, and written in 1602, after Campella had been condemned to life in prison for sedition and heresy. The city elite set on the... The city of the title, set on the island of Trapani, now Sri Lanka, is benignly presided over by a priest prince called Sun. Now, this is so interesting. It was really interesting about the Sun King. He was so much self-aware of being the Sun King. I was just reading A Little Chaos. It got nothing of the complete over-the-top fantasy. Like, they did big spectacular fantasy, but they had really no idea of the fantasy of Louis XIV. Both Shakespeare, 1564 to 1616, and John Donne, 1572 to 1631, were Campella's contemporaries. The former's use of the sun characteristically defies generalization. He's never a keen observer of the heavens, referring to the sun more than 40 times in the late plays alone. Many of the references occur in an itinerary form that has its origin in classical poetry, but which was brought to perfection by the troubadours of medieval Provence and the Mensengers of Germany, the Oberde, a short lyric of love fulfilled, supposedly uttered at dawn, as opposed to the serenade sung by a hopeful suitor in the evening, and generally lamenting the lover's bid farewell to the joys of night. It has been suggested that the form was an ingenious development from the cry of a night watchman announcing the coming day. Shakespeare made glorious use of obeids, typically planting them as hinge points in his plays, classically in Romeo and Juliet. Or I wish I knew what obeids mean. Over the centuries, the obeids were adapted for other purposes. The Victorians, for instance, using it for graver kind of lament. Intercessors did In Memoriam. Perhaps the best known of the English obeids is Donne's The Sun Rising, which opens seductively. Busy old fool, unruly sun, why dost thou thus, through windows and through curtains, call on us? Must thy motions, lovers, seasons run? If this is the first instance of a poet mocking the sun, I have found none earlier. In Donne's case, there is a reason. In 1601, he had secretly married a 17-year-old Anne, daughter of Sir George Moore. The Diminutive Irascible Lieutenant of the Tower of London. A short man with a short fuse, Don's latest biographers called him. He wrote of a visit to the Liberal Father, "Sir, I acknowledge my fault to be so great as I dare sacrifice, offer any other prayer to you in mine own behalf that this, to believe that I neither had dishonest end nor means. I humbly beg you that she may not, to her danger, feel the terror of your sudden anger." Sir George replied by having him thrown into the Fleet Prison for some weeks, along with the priest who performed the marriage, attempting unsuccessfully to annul the union and getting Don's employer to dismiss him. Isn't that amazing? She is so. John, that's one aspect. You read John Donne about death, be not afraid, and all that type of stuff. I'll mock you. John Donne and Donne Undone went the popular epigram attributed to Don himself. For the next decade, the poet and his family struggled in near poverty, not until 1609, where he and his father-in-law reconciled. But for the perspective of immortality, Don definitely had the last word. Sir George had published his own vision of sunrise, borrowing from the Psalms, a very different one from Don's. "Who seeth the glorious arising of the sun, his coming forth as a bride's groom out of his chamber, his rejoicing like a mighty man to run his race. Of course, the sun goeth around the earth, and the light, and his light will have entrance whatever the body of man can have passage." With the sun rising, Donne achieves the ultimate poetic payback. He was to write a number of other poems deploying the sun as a metaphor. But he also wrote a satire, Ignatius's Conclave, in which course of attacking Jesuits, for Donne was a fervent Anglican convert from Rome, ridiculed many of the scientific theories, and particularly the argument that the earth circled the sun. Isn't that amazing? It's interesting, the Jesuits and the church was putting across, the Anglicans and stuff were pushing back, the Anglicans and the Lutherans were putting back. He was to express his views more forcefully in verse. "A new philosophy call all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost and the earth, and no man's wit can direct him where well to look for it." This appeared in 1611, and the same year in which Galileo purported the existence of spots on the sun, valleys and the moon. By 1690, Newton had explained the operation of gravity, the makeup of the sun's rays, and the origin of arrangements. The scientific revolution was in full flood, whether the world of poetry liked it or not, and certainly were those in the world who did not. William Blake, for instance, had no use for science. In his view, the advantages of one of the evils of the day, one poem mentions the sun, but without the post-Copernican trappings. And I really do feel that this is not the first generation which has revolted against science. It's just there's less place to hide from it, and so you're a little bit more exposed. Okay, and so this is a poem by William Blake. "Ah, sunflower, weary of time, who countest the steps of the sun, seeking after the sweet golden clime. Where the traveller's journey is done." That doesn't seem a problem with that. "This poem variously interpreted, the image usually taken to represent man's yearning to escape the transit of the world for the golden eternity of the next. Blake may have also been alluding to the Greek legend in which the sunflower was created when a woman pined away her desire after the sun god, and so turned into a flower. But whatever the meaning we finally assign, there was a major poet using the sun for symbolic purposes that were quite separate from any scientific findings." Gee, that's a bit hard to believe. Samuel Coleridge, who is our famous inventor of the word scientist. Samuel Coleridge, 1772 to 1834. It was him who had interactions with Wee War. Was a more typical man of the time. "I shall attack chemistry like a shark," he wrote enthusiastically in 1800 on the occasion of his going to London to attend lectures on science, primarily to feast on a new stock of metaphors. He, like many of his fellow romantics, sought to break into science's magic circle, be it fashioned by mathematicians or physicists, chemists or biologists. Far ignoring the new truths of cosmology, they wanted to understand them. Of course, those 19th century poets writing in English, for example, Lord Byron, was vitally interested in scientific matters, especially in astronomy and geology. So too was Robert Browning, who called Shelley the sun threader and commended him for his hymn to Apollo with the radiant sun gods. Percy Bysshe Shelley did work as a chemist, introducing scientific material into poems as Queen Mab, Prometheus Unbound. And while his hymn to Apollo, the god calls himself the eye of the universe, beholds itself and knows itself divine. John Keats, who studied medicine, regularly employs astronomical images, his long poem Hyperion, The Fall of Hyperion, both being named of the classical sun gods. Besides them, Emerson said, oh, look at me, it's hard to say, these people have knowledge of the classics. They don't have the exhaustive, reconstructed knowledge of people who have put the classics together bit by bit, argued it, and new forensic evidence. They were taught the classics. They could study it, and they knew it. And so they perpetuate mistakes, as far as I can see. Besides them, Emerson, Holmes, Poe, Tennyson, Harold, Hardy, the sun rested his chin upon the meadows. Coventry, Pulitzer, and Charles Dickens, often in the context of weather in general, but in particular grimness in Bleak House, in the opening chapter of Little Dot, wrote specifically on solar themes. Emily Dickinson, I wish I knew about her. Gee, my memory is going. So, what is it? Schopenhauer, I want to read it. Composed a poem that poked fun at the post-Copernican understanding of the cosmos. The earth upon its axis was once supposed to turn Ransa Transit Gloria Mundi, by the way, a gymnastic in honour of the sun. But the truth is that, for all their professed interest in science, from 1750 on, for almost 150 years, when poets sat down to write, they continued to prefer the safer passages of old myths. The sun was still decked out as Apollo, Hellas, Hyperion, Phoebus. Its identity was a rolling ball of gases that was but one of many stars in the galaxies was not yet a stuff of poetry. But the new findings of science could not be ignored, and the overall exerted what was thought to be a negative influence. Eventually, Macaulay, who was to become the first apostle of progress, accepted the decline of poetry as an unavoidable result of scientific revelations. And as poetry, as science was advancing, the last bastion was opera. That's in my view. While I argue that societies advance in rational achievements, so they tend to lose the great skill that rests in imagination. I couldn't agree with Hegel more. Hegel is such a fantastic scholar in terms of that he's more pure than Marxism. But was it, his view of more and more bureaucracy. By the return of the century, the great scholar of the classical world's knowledge in the heavens was E.A. Hausmann. In old age, he wrote the Times Literary Supplement. Quintilian says you will never understand the poets unless you learn astronomy. And that may have been true for the ancients, Hausmann's fields of study, but not for his fellow poets. At least one old myth, however, has persisted throughout the centuries, the legend of the phoenix and its metaphor of solar rebirth and the sun dying daily death in the west and being reborn in the east, crossing the sky of the heavens like an arching bird. Hesiod firstly assigned the phoenix its great longevity, and he also introduced the idea of cyclical time as birth and reborns. History repeated itself. Until the 17th century, many believed that the phoenix really existed. Shakespeare, notably The Phoenix and the Turtle, Apollinaire, by the name making himself Son of the Sun, Byron Nish, who signed himself Phoenix and wrote himself as a creature reborn. Nietzsche is such a complex person. But I now understand that's supposed to be Zarathustra. But did Shakespeare really believe in anything? Like, he's such a complex dude. Mamere, Yeats all drew on the myth. E. Nesbitt and her children's novel, The Physics in the Carpet, makes the bird a creature of great vanity and considerable eccentricity. In more recent times, Harry Potter encounters the Phoenix Forks, owned by the headmaster Albus Dumbledore, while the X-Men mutant comic book superhero Jean Grey requires a powerful Phoenix Force.
Most notably, Sonaro de Bergerac's unfinished work, History des States d'Empire de la Lune et le Sol, recounts the journey whose narrator reaches the Empire of the Sun, where he meets a phoenix. The tale underlines Cicero's belief that there is burning souls within human beings that is in touch with the sun, the great soul of the world. Well, this actually pins back. But I mean, I think comic books have really made accessible, but also degraded the myths. You know, I think no one really believes in it more. Such theory have appealed strongly to D.H. Lawrence, who, in 1885 to 1930s, whose poem Phoenix explored just an idea. Lawrence brings the myth into his novels, and at one point, he even adopted the bird as his personal symbol. He could be ridiculous and even repulsive. Bernard Russell thought he heralded the Nazis and his anti-Semitism and phallocentric philosophy. Yeah, like, you have to understand that we are reading very select texts, and if you just read the raw text, raw Roman text, or raw stuff, you just come across these hugely racist, absurd stories. But he did celebrate the sun to memorable effect. His preoccupation began early. Nottingham, his birthplace, a grimy coal mining city, endured throughout his life. The final pages of his great novel, Sons and Lovers, describes the night when poor Morrell comes to terms with having renounced his mistress and buried his mother. Everywhere the vastness and terror of the immense night, which aroused and stirred the belief, while by the day by which returns had will remain at last central, night in which everything was lost, went reaching out beyond the stars and the sun, a few bright grains, and went spinning around the terror, holding for each in embrace there in darkness that outpassed them all and left them tiny and daunted, so much and himself into Tessalon, at the core of nothingness and yet not nothing. But no, he would not give in. Turning sharply, he walked towards the city's gold phosphorescence. He would not take that direction to follow her. He walked towards the faintly humming, glowing town quickly. I don't quite understand what that means. Here, as always, Lawrence, the sun is regenerative, a gold echo of phosphorescence, the city calling Mockel back to life. Nowhere do we see this more clearly than in the short story The Sun, a Fian and Life-Giving Powers, in which Harry Crosby's Black Sun Press published in 1928. It tells the refined New York lady dispatched to the Sicilian coast to recuperate from postpartum depression. "You know, Juliet," her mother advises, "the doctor told you to lie in the sun without your clothes." "And why don't you?" So she does, and soon the sun gradually... Oh dear. Penetrating to know her, the cosmic carnal sense of the word, and not to be denied, a local about her age suddenly appears as the raven close to her rented garden. Ah, the Laurentian peasant. Now the strange challenge of his eye had held her, blue and overwhelmed by the sun's blue heart. And she had seen the fierce stirring of the phallus under his thin trousers for her. And with his red face and with his broad body, he was like the sun to her, the sun in a broad heat. There you go. Juliet is loath to make the first approach, and her admirer waits the endlessly for initiative with the dogged passivity of the earth. And into her sunny retreat there, her husband suddenly arrives, an utterly sunless Morris, a man who, the soul of a gentle timidity in human relations. So Juliet, being so sun, could not see him. His sunlessness was like non-entity. But she realizes that it is her grey spouse that will have to settle for. She had not enough courage, and she was not free enough. Even though her lust remains unconsummated, the story must rate as the purest expression of her rock power with the sun exposure in all literature. Well, that's... Yep, I'm not going to argue with that. But Lawrence was not finished during Easter 29 when he was in a Tuscan village shop window, a toy white rooster bursting out of an egg. This inspired the escape cock, retitled Lawrence's Wishes, The Man Who Died. The story of a resurrected, a sexually potent son of God, the image of a lotus stands in the form of a female sex organ. No other flower offers her soft golden depth to penetration of the flooding violet dark sun that has died and risen. There is something wonderfully daft about the punning here, in which Lafony is at least of the provocations. He crouched to her. He felt the blaze of his manhood and his power rise up in his loins, magnificent. I am risen, magnificent, blazing, indomitable depths of his loins. His sun has dawned. Oh, well, there you go. Shortly after this, Lawrence wrote The Middle Classes, a poem in which he describes Morris's world as sunless. They have only two measures, mankind and money. They have utterly no reference to the sun. But there is hardly a work of Lawrence that does not touch on these themes. In his last book, Apocalypse, written in the winter of 29-30, he was dying amid general condemnation of his works, he wrote, "Don't let us imagine we see the sun as an old civilization saw. All we see is a scientific little luminary dwindled to a ball of blazing gas. In realities before Ezekiel and John, the sun was still a magnificent reality. Men drew forth from him threatening and splendor and gave him back homage and thanks." And that is actually rather beautiful. I have to really get my head into gear. In his final work, Lawrence urged mankind to reestablish its primal connection with the cosmos. Without meditation and science, all we saw as reductiveness. Start with the sun and the rest of the body will show steadily happened. He ends the book. Even more fervent, Apostle of the Sun, not coincidentally fan of Lawrence and fellow sun worshipper, was millionaire American hedonist poet of the 1920s who died in a suicide pact. Oh my God, this is getting pretty rich. 31. Who it was his name? A fugitive from the bad Scotch Fitzgerald novel was one obituary described him. In this is a theatrical way to reintroduce Harry Crosby. But everything about Crosby springs from the pages of melodrama. Both Malcolm Crawley in Exile's Return and Geoffrey Wolfe in Black Sun wrote at length about him. While Paul Fussell, he was the ultimately mad American whose life showed the power of the sun to take over the entire malleable mind. Crosby's own writing, avant-garde, experimental, surreal, deeply off-putting, was supported by great wealth, wholly inherited and effectively multiplied by his living in Europe when the franc was very weak. The money allowed him to refurbish a medieval meal, inevitably Moulin de Sol, outside Paris, into a luxurious country house and travel to exotic destination whenever he wished. Experimenting photography, pushed his Bugatti to the limits, and even learnt to fly solo at a time when the airplane was a gadget so new that no one had agreed on its spelling. Descended from the old New England money, J.P. Morgan was an uncle. He enlisted the Field Service Ambulance Corps early in World War I, serving in Verdun on receiving the Croix de Guerre and surviving a wound that should have killed him. After an accelerated degree at Harvard, and a scandalous marriage to a woman 6 years his senior, whom he induced to leave her husband, he settled in France buying a race horses, sampling opium, drinking excess and travelling. He started to write. In 1927, he launched the Black Sun Press, which I think wrote D.H. Lawrence, had a solar face tattooed on his back as an expression of devotion, and elicited his first short story from Lawrence, whom he paid in sunny $20 gold pieces. Gosby was developing an obsessive interest in the imagery centered on the sun, which he introduced in his own writings with vengeance. The black sun symbolized his attempt to unify the forces of life and death, but the visual design it also carried sexual significance. Every doodle of a black sun that Cosby added to his signature, writes one biographer, also included an arrow jutting from one upward from the Y, Cosby's last name, and aiming for the center of the sun's circle, a phallic thrust received by a welcoming erogenous zone. Oh, God, this... I don't know. It really is soft porn, isn't it? Dress up in literature. It is really interesting to read a history of English literature. In that English literature, like, they didn't teach English at Oxford to 1900 or Cambridge to 1911. So English literature is a new thing, and I think this is just soft porn. Cosby comes across almost totally unpleasant, yet he is not so far off in his view from Lawrence's Creed in Apocalypse. And this is a quote. What man most passionately wants in his living wholeness and his unison, and ever since he and now life in the flesh of ours, and ours alone, ours only for a time, we ought to dance with rapture, and we should be alive in the flesh and part of the living, incarnate cosmos, whatever that means. By the mid-1920s, Cosby had published an elaborate diary of years 22 to 26, Shadows of the Sun, as well as two volumes of poetry, the first entitled Chariots of the Sun. The other Black Sun projects included works by Harriet Crane, James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, and Man Ray. As a spottier talent, Cosby was not without gifts. So, now this really gets to me in terms of, for all this, it's the boom and bust. It's the error signal and in civilizations. So I think we rebuilt the railways. The boom was funded by, you know, helpless people who never got their money back. These booms build the infrastructure for the next generation, which we tend to leap off, and we take the investment in the future for granted. Okay, here's a footnote about Cosby. Okay, only a few more pages. The Black Sun was and had other connotations. Russia's great symbolist poet Ossip Manstrom, 1891 to 1938, records, I have recalled the image of Pushkin's burial. Pushkin fell in a duel in 1837 to arouse in memory the image of a night sun. The language occurs throughout Mussorgsky's Trisana, which lines as, the mother in love, the black sun will rise, the sun's role seems to vary, finally linking with the Christian Apocalyptic tradition. The black sun image also connects with Manstrom's ambivalence about the Bolshevik revolution, which he wanted to, I'm reading out in the bush here, so there's ants and all that type of crap. Okay. Oh yeah, I'm reading it back here. The Black Sun's image connects with, okay, which endorses but seemed to be bringing darkness, not light. It is only represents the death of Pacific people, but becomes a symbol of Russia itself. The sun forced is as a force of despair. By now, this is Cosby's, he was interested in the philosophical applications of suicide, and indeed had been openly obsessing about death for the last 5 years. Time is tyranny to be abolished. One last ultra venture was called for. His second book of poetry, Transit of Venus, had been inspired by Jocelyn Notch, newly Mrs. Albert Smith Bigelow, a woman with whom he could spend the last week of his life. On the 9th of December 1929, the day before he died, Josephine wrote to Cosby a passionate verse letter that ends by insisting, the sun is our God and the death of our marriage. He was found with a 25 caliber gunshot to the right temple. She had been shot in the left and died first. Oh dear. It's a suicide pact. Bit bizarre. During and after the years which Cosby was gallivanting around his adopted country, the literary world had been the heart of a love affair with the sun. Host of writers had now acclaimed it, and without a heavenly philosophical trappings, the new message was the sun gets into everything. With W.H. Auden's The Icarus, for instance, the 1st of September 1939 was about a boy who flew close to a fire, but must be one of the... This is why don't we have the Icarus legend here? He just must assume everyone must know it. Most famous lines of some literature, the Yeats, are two in the Song of Wandering Aeneas, are silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun, lines written in dejection and unforgettably, the second coming, the glazed blank of pitiless sun invoked the star, while the realm of light versus pride and place goes to John Bridgerton, a subaltern's love song, 1941. With its unforgettable lines, Miss J. Hunter Dunn, Miss J. Hunter Dunn, furnished and burnished by Aldous' son. One of Albert's poems, none so successfully converted suburban trivia into hilarious helter-skelter eroticism. Maybe, as Sir Joseph Brodsky said, all the best poets are solar powered. Let's see, okay. And there's a big footnote here, so are you ready for a big footnote? Among the novels offering solar passages of note was Moby Dick. Dying sperm whales turn their heads towards the sun. The Wind in the Willows and The Rat and the Mole are granted the epiphany of sunrise. Playwrights, too, have recorded the sun as an overwhelming presence, from Tennessee Williams to Peter Schaefer, whose Royal Hunt for the Sun, 64, attempts to recapture the world in which the Inca of the Spanish conquest and whose Equus, yeah, would be delighted. Lawrence Hyperlon, 1797-9, the first novel of the German lyric poet Friedrich Hölderlin, is a large part of the analysis of the sun role in Western philosophy. Colette, 1873-1954, reveals Isidore that during her childhood her mother would reward good behaviour by letting her see dawn. The division into poets and novelists is an artificial one, but the list of fiction writers could continue. John O'Hara, August the Game, William Faulkner, Light, August, and The Evening Sun, Patrick White, an Aussie, Doris Lessing, both particularly good tropical relentlesses. This Elizabeth Bowen, A World of Love, William, it just goes on and on. I'll spare you that footnote, just all these people. So he knows a lot of literature, good on you. The literature of almost every culture contains a share of solar allusions. Sir Arthur Rimbaud, 1854-91, Paul Verlaine, 1844-96, for instance, shared an ambivalence about the sun. As the Venetian scholar Amerit Sol comments, quote, where Rimbaud's quest for a kind of cosmic revelation made him worship the sun's power and absorb and take him over, Verlaine's poems reveal most equal fascination with the sun, but as a star whose force is shrouded, guarded, and veiled by intangible. In a fascinating way, the two poets' concern with the sun is two sides of the coin. For Rimbaud, who produced nearly all his best work before he was 20, the sun was either a mask of social evil or a bringer of misery. Quote, the hearth of affection and life, it pours burning love onto the light of the earth, he wrote. But his last years were spent in the desert heat of East Africa, which seared him into a decidedly less receptive frame of mind. Quote, I saw the low sun stained with mystic horrors, he confided wretchedly to a friend, where in a stream baths of springtime, skins are dripping, stomachs turning sour, brains becoming muddled. But in the end, the sun, which shines like scoured cauldron, won through, and on his deathbed he wept to his then-companion Isabel, that never again would he feel its light. I shall go under the earth, and you shall walk in the sun. Oh my God, listen to this. Sorry, this is, you know, how does this all happen? When Norman Mailer was courting Barbara, his sixth wife, he wrote to her, and you stand up, lady, are golden as the sun. She later replied in verse, you were there and I was there in a pocket of sunshine. The New York Times commented, these two lived large, sun-drenched lives in almost every regard. Well, six wives, pretty amazing. Good God. Thinly veiled autobiography continued with the novels of André Gide in 1869-51. In his first book, The Immoralist, 1902, is narrated by Michel, a scholar who spends his early years in northern France. He marries and honeymoons in North Africa and finds his world changed. I came to think in very astonishing thing to be alive that every day shone for me. As did for Lawrence, the sun becomes a liberating power, leaving his bride behind. Michelle embarks on the Mediterranean adventure, immediately drawn into the beautiful brown suburban skins of Italian boys. He is shamed to tears and to his own witness, opening his body to the sun, sets about transformation. I expose my whole body to the flame. I sat down, lay down, turned myself about. Soon, delicious burning enveloped me. My whole being surged into my skin. Freed from restraint, he becomes the brown immortalist of the novel's title. Oscar Wilde, who once mentioned to Gide that the sun hates our auditor's thoughts, and sure enough, Michael is soon concluding that existing is an occupation enough. Okay. Wow. Yeah, it's just, I suppose, really interesting what he, you know, the bits and pieces he's left off. He's got such a big, vast knowledge of literature that it sort of almost sucks me in. He really is, you know, like he's showing off his literature, he's showing off his science without really understanding. In The Outsider, 1994, Albert Camus, the protagonist of and his protagonist, Merced, kill a North African on a blazingly hot beach, apparently for no reason. That being the point. And Unreason, the name that Camus attaches to his sunblasted enduring experiences. Declaiming the philosophy of the rebel in 1953, he wrote, historic absolutism, despite its triumphs, was never ceased to come into conclusion with irrepressible demands of human nature of the Mediterranean, where intelligence is ultimately related into blinding light of the sun guards the secret. When Sartre was asked if Camus, a close friend, was also an existentialist, he replied, no, that's a grave misconception. I would call him his pessimism solar, if you remember how much black there is in the sun. Camus's own comment was, to correct a natural indifference, I was placed halfway between the misery and the sun. Misery kept me from believing that all was well under the sun, and the sun taught me that history wasn't everything. Well, this is a bit bizarre. They're off in their own world. What becomes clear is that the mid-20th century, the sun could serve almost any literary purpose, symbol, metaphor, inspiration, erratic force, ultimate companion, intransigent adversary, comic but tragic and game, source of redemption, and source of philosophical belief. Literature is so remarkable because Dacus makes use of the sun in nearly all these ways. Now, that's a nice way that he puts it together. But you know what? This is written well, but it hasn't got that. I would love an element of structure to help me understand it. And still, the literary exploration of the sun goes on. In 2008, the American novelist Elizabeth Strout published Oliver Kitchard's 13 interconnected stories about a retired teacher in the fictional coastal town of Crosby, Maine. It won the Pulitzer Prize, an extraordinary perceptive narrative about love and acceptance. It does not use the sun metaphysically in the way that Norcross does, but as a presence or absence that affects everyone in Crosby, particularly the prickly, truculent Miss Kittredge. Stout and wonderfully observant about, say, the abandonment of a sunbather or the light emerging through the fog or making a red grass on the bureau grow glass. A strip of wooden floor shines like honey under the block of winter sun, while later sun lingers across a snow-covered field and makes a violet colour. But it is more than that. In a short book, there are 70 solar references, with the sun acting as a guide to characters and the characters should do. By the novel's end, Olive, a newly widowed, suddenly finds a local widower who seems to love him. Will she seize her chance? She puts about and turn away when the sun gives her a sudden surging greediness for life. She remembered what hope was, and that was it. She pictured the sunny room, the sunny wash wall, and the bravery outside. It baffled her, the world. She didn't want to leave it yet. It is interesting there. Okay, busy old fool.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. may you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.